Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
Today, he's back with us, and the world is a very different place. The U.S. has now reported nearly 17 million cases and over 303,000 deaths. And while vaccines have arrived, America has some grim days ahead, having to endure a near 9/11 level event every day for the next 60 to 90 days, according to the CDC. And economies are in a very different place. The pandemic has cost the world about 8% of GDP this year. China is growing. The monetary taps are on globally. But fiscal authorities are slower to act than they were in the spring. We've got a new American president upcoming who's about to hit the quadrennial reset button. What it all means is perilous uncertainty for corporate managements and boards as they navigate the pandemic and uneven global economic recovery, the largest social justice movement in American history with global spillover, climate change, a rising China, and perhaps the biggest rethink of the social responsibility of the corporation since Milton Friedman's seminal New York Times Magazine essay in 1970. So I can think of nobody better to finish out our year because he has got thoughts on all of these things, and so I'm happy to have him back. Lord Davies of Aberystwyth is chairman of the international investment firm Letter One. He's chairman of the private equity firm Corsair Capital, which specializes in financial services. And he's chairman of Intermediate Capital Group. Previously, he was the chairman and CEO of Standard Chartered. Beyond his business interests, he was the Minister of State for Trade, Investment, and Business in the cabinet of the Labor Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. He is the chairman of the Lawn Tennis Association, which brings us the Wimbledon Championship every year. And he's the chairman of Glyndebourne Productions, which is the beautiful opera house in the English countryside. And he sits in the House of Lords. I, on the other hand, sit at home and work for Teneo. But Marvin, before we get to all of the uncertainties of 2021, I want to ask you about something we do know for certain, and that's Brexit. The transition year ends on December the 31st. I know that negotiations are ongoing, but we're getting perilously close to the end of the year. My question for you is, you know, what do you expect? What do you think is going to happen between UK and EU negotiators, and where are we going to get?
Well, firstly, Kevin, great to be on the 34th webinar. So I think what you've provided in the webinar series has been fantastic. So congratulations.
Thanks
and
so
great
much.
To be back. For those of you that you can't see me, so I'm sat at home, not in the House of Lords. By the way, I don't think the House of Lords has very good Wi-Fi, but look, if the timing of Brexit could not be more unfortunate. We have every country, you know, in the world has a COVID crisis on its hands, has to borrow more money, and has to get a vaccination program in place at a time of, you know, borrowing more money and economic decline. So to have the uncertainty of Brexit is extraordinarily unhelpful. To be honest, I don't think anybody outside of Boris Johnson negotiating team has any idea. I would have said last Friday that it was highly likely we'd crash out without a deal, which would have catastrophic consequences, in my humble opinion. But then I think they realized that, and the mood of business, and everybody was to say, you know, your job as politicians, you've been at it for 4.5 years. You need to get this sorted. So I'm more optimistic, but I think it's very 50-50. And I find it ironic that we're arguing, you know, with Europeans about fishing rights, which represents such a small part of our economy. And yet financial services, which is 16, 17%, whatever it is, you know, doesn't get a mention. So very important to hopefully get a deal before the end of the year. If there is no deal, then I think the political ramifications for the government will be quite serious.
You bring up the point of the negotiation over fisheries. It's worth noting that that the fishing industry represents a percentage of GDP to the UK, which is about the same as the Harrods department store itself. But so what it really comes down to, though, is sovereignty, which is right. I mean, the fisheries and level playing field and all of that is a proxy for sovereignty, the umbrella issue. So what do you think the UK will have gained then once it is what is that reintroduction of sovereignty going to ultimately give the country?
Well, look, I'm an optimist by nature. And when I look at Letter One, the company that I'm chairman of, you look at our wide array of, you know, energy, technology, retail, healthcare businesses, and we're long-term investors, we see the UK as a great place to do business, and long may that continue. I would sort of widen the discussion a little bit. I think what's happened during Trump's presidency is this culture of America first. What it did was it resulted in a mood swing and increased populism around the world, which was around about, well, look after your own country. It doesn't matter about, you know, globalization. It doesn't, you know, forget about global cooperation. So I think over the last few years, we've seen, unlike the financial crisis, which, you know, that's how I ended up in government, there was huge cooperation, G8, G20. To a degree, it's fallen apart, gone backwards. So I think, you know, at WHO, the, you know, World Bank, the cooperation on a crisis like the one we're going through, the global cooperation just disappeared and every country's been looking after itself. So that mood, that increased populism led obviously to a decision, you know, by the voters to have Brexit. I was a very passionate Remainer, but we are where we are. So I'm optimistic about the future of the UK because it's a very innovative country, but I'm disappointed that we're no longer part of the European, or going to be part of the European Union.
Now, to some degree, we have not seen, or at least we have yet to see, some of the worst effects. You refer to the financial services industry. We have not seen a completely wholesale move from London to other financial centers in Europe and whatnot. But I guess my question for you is, assuming we get a deal, which obviously is going to be a pretty bare bones deal at best, But I agree with you about the optics and the political ramifications of that. But where do you think the first, I mean, I know we have these fears that we're going to see lines of trucks at Dover or Calais waiting to get in and get to the other side and all of the sort of logistical challenges. But from a political perspective, like, where do you fear the first conflicts could come between the UK and the EU moving forward?
I think it is on the very issues you highlighted there. I think, you know, one of the great aspects of logistics and freedom of movement of goods across the world has been, and we see it in, you know, the way that the Amazons of the world are able to do it. I think we're in a digital age where products from all over the world can come to your home in a matter of hours. And we have to make sure that that partnership with Europe doesn't, you know, destabilize. So the free transportation of goods, medicines, food, etc., very critical issues for me. I think the other thing is that the UK had a spell where immigration became the big issue during the Brexit debate. For me, it's a personal view, but I think immigration, you know, controlled is unbelievably good for your culture, and that has added huge strength to the growth of the UK. So I think that what we have to watch is that we restrict talent coming into the country, by making it so tough to, you know, get visas for work, etc. So for me, in this era of flexible working and more international culture and companies, we've got to make sure that we have an open market for talent. I think there's going to be an argument over that.
Yeah. So let's step back and look at the bigger picture here. I teed up the environment that we're in at the beginning of the call here, but it seems to me that there's been.
I was pretty depressed by the time you finished, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. I do think that there's been a change, though, in the trajectory of some of the big tectonic trends that are out there in the world that have been shifted by the pandemic and the response, particularly by the United States and some of the other major powers. But there's been changes in the trajectories of globalization. The digital revolution has been clearly accelerated. The U.S.-China rivalry has only gotten more intense. And, of course, looming all over all of this is climate change. So, you know, in contrast to what we were talking about back in May, you know, what have you and by you, I'm talking about you as a proxy for board chairman everywhere here. You know, what have you learned? What has not played out as you would have expected back in May? And what are the big adjustments that you're making or being forced to make as you head into 2021 and the prospects for recovery?
You know, I think, you know, I had dinner with the or drinks with the CEO of LetterOne this week. And, you know, we were talking about what are the lessons we've learned. And I think whether you're a CEO chairman or an individual, you're going to look at what have I learned about myself? What have I learned about the company during the last 12 months? I think we've realized the value of family. We've realized the value of communities. We've realized also in a different way how important work is. And I think we've also realized that the world and companies within it can work in a completely different way. The old model has gone. And so we are going to see more flexibility in the workplace. We're going to see more digitalization. We're going to see the impact and importance of youth in a company and in a culture grow. And I think additionally, and you mentioned a number of the issues, we're going to see more and more and more focus on ESG and climate change. So it's not sort of going too broad with the answer, but I think, you know, inequality has increased across the world as a result of the crisis. You know, you look at the food and beverage industry in the UK, it employs 3 million people. A huge percentage of those people are going to be unemployed. The impact across America, across the world on certain sectors, which you refer to, is going to be profound. So I think every chief executive has a full in-tray he or she will have to manage at the beginning of 21.
So I want to unpack some of that, but before I do, you know, you sort of alluded to something, and I'm just interested in your thoughts. You know, people are always, especially as we get to the end of the year and everybody's prognosticating what's to come, and I feel like we've had some early obituaries for the role of the city in the world, not the city of London, but the cities in general, and we hear about it a lot here in New York. Corporations moving out, people, you know, doing more work from home, so they're moving to either lower cost environments or where they can have more space or better weather or whatever the case may be. You know, and we've heard this before when cities have gotten carved up in the past, but they're pretty resilient and there's a lot of things that can only happen really in cities due to the scale they afford. But what do you think about places like New York and London and how they have been permanently changed? Or do you think that they're more resilient than that and they're going to bounce back?
No, I still think cities are, you know, very resilient. I think cities become centers of excellence. for industries. They become like a cluster of activity. Now, some of the clusters may move to the edge of the cities, but are we going to see a total removal of talent, senior execs, and business into the rural areas? No, I don't think so. I think short term, what this does, it forces every chief executive to start the year, and or maybe it's in March or whenever, when it's a little bit clearer the picture on vaccines and COVID. I think that as a chief executive, having been one, you've now got to think, right, what have I learned about the culture of my firm during the last year? I've seen some people rise to the challenge like any crisis, and I've seen some people disappear. So those people that, of all ages and all, stages in the company, who's really, really risen to help me as a leader in the crisis? So that's number one. How has the culture of my company been affected? Because I've not been able as a leader to see my people in the same way as before. I've had to become, which I used to be a stand sharp because, your nearest operating unit was 8 hours away. So you had to become what I describe as a remote manager. So I think there's a huge debate to be had about, what's been the impact of COVID on the culture of your company? How flexible are you? And how can you speed up the digital reform, as I mentioned? So I think that CEOs are going to have to think very differently about their businesses. Now, do I think that they will have to look at the location, strategy, et cetera? Yeah, absolutely. But I do not believe the cities are dead and, everybody's, a lot of people I see in my personal life have suddenly said, right, we're moving to the countryside. That's it. I'm getting out of London or whatever it might be, or even New York. And then you say, well, what happens if we decide to do 3 days a week in the office? I'll cross that bridge when we come to it. So I think there's going to be a lot of reversing of lifestyles.
So you talked a lot about culture of an organization, and you've talked about the people who have become influential in the way you're thinking. I'm wondering if that's a different profile than people who have had that influence in past crises. Are you having to look deeper in organizations to sort of look forward in a sense, sort of get the ideas of how to move forward? And if it is a different profile, and if you are having to look deeper, what are the long-term implications of what leadership, and by leadership, I'm talking about C-suites and boards, is going to look like? Or am I making too much of this?
excuse me. I think I've said this before to you, that in the past, you reach the top of a company or a private entity, and with years of experience, you develop the intuition to make decisions. And the youth that were coming through the company would look upstairs to, get the words of wisdom. But that's now changed. And those at the top of the company are having to really engage with the youth of the company in a very different way. And that is because the speed of change in the digitalization of everything is so fast. And they will have a better grasp of the issues than you will at the top. They'll have a better sense of what the new generation is feeling about diversity, about climate change. And, we talk a lot about this at Letter One, actually, in terms of, how do we engage with private long-term investors? How do we become a leader in ESG? And how do we make sure that we're really engaging with the youth? So, yeah, I do think that is different. If you're at the top of a company, a lot of listeners will be in the top 100 or whatever the number is in a company. I think you've got to figure out how I engage with young people in a different way. because the speed of change is so rapid. You've got to read more. You've got to stay relevant. Otherwise, you become a prehistoric monster pretty quickly.
You know, at the beginning of our conversation, I alluded to Milton Friedman's 1970 article. And for those who are unfamiliar with it, I mean, basically, he laid out the premise that the social responsibility of the corporation is to maximize profits, and then by extension, to maximize their stock price. Are we seeing an evolution of that social contract? I know for years, regulators have tried to impose themselves on corporate behavior, and certainly activists have not activist investors, but activists out in the NGO world and the like. But now, increasingly, with benchmarks that are related to ESG and whatnot, investors and institutional investors themselves are becoming more forceful on this front. And leaders in the industry, Larry Fink and Jamie Dimon, but obviously also the incoming Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, all sort of at the forefront of this. How do you see the evolution of the role of the corporation and that what that also means for the profile of leadership?
Well, I think it's profound change. You know, I'm old enough to have lived through. No criticism of him at all meant in saying this, but the Jack Welch era, it was all about driving shareholder value. And then it became, when I was CEO, we started to talk more about CSR. And I remember talking about CSR and, the shareholders, I mean, they were yawning. Yeah, but what's your EPS? You know, what are your earnings per share going to be this quarter, this half? But, you know, when I look back on my time, a CEO, one of the thing I'm most proud of is the stuff that we did in seeing and believing in terms of curing cataract operations and making a difference across the world. So we went through a CSR era, and today we're going through a new era where, yes, of course, you're not going to survive as an exec if you don't, produce the returns. But you've got to, I used to use the expression a decade ago, profit with principles. I think it's gone up a notch. You've got to be minded to care for your employees, care for the communities in which you operate in, and you have absolutely got to embrace ESG. And if you don't, your staff will kill you or the customers will. So I think the nature of I think the CEOs or the companies or the boards listening that don't get this and they say, yeah, that's just a trend, it'll pass. Well, you're going to die. You're going to die as a business.
And what do you think? And what's driving this seminal moment? Is it the standardization of how to measure this and institutional investors adhering to it? Is it the power that has been handed to the to your customers via social media and other campaigns? Is it broader activism, or is it just that the stars have aligned on all of those things now? Not to mention then the dislocations caused by the pandemic and the social justice movement that puts everything in stark relief. Is it that confluence of factors, or is there something else catalyzing?
No. Oh, I honestly think we're in a more transparent world where bad things are more visible. You can see them on, whether it's any social media channel. You get it immediate. So there's an immediacy to bad news, to bad behavior, etc. There's nowhere to hide now. And so I think rising inequality, rising issues around climate change, literally been brought to everybody's home, and the consumerism and the wastage that goes with it, everybody now feels, companies now embrace it. They realize, not all companies, but great companies do, great management teams realize that in a world of rising inequality, rising debt levels, with more regionalization, that actually We have to do more because we're passing on a world that will deteriorate very fast to the next generation. So I think, and we've seen it right across the world, we certainly saw it right across the UK, this emotion, this wave of emotion towards the NHS and towards helping everybody almost as mankind across the country during COVID. So for me, I do think that genuinely management teams and individuals are going to have to step up the game on ESG and other issues. And diversity, we have seen some horrible activity in the US, and that has shocked the world. And we have just got to get better and better on diversity. Otherwise, activism and trouble will rise.
So, this is a perfect segue, I think, because if we're going to talk about the evolving role of the corporation, inevitably we have to ask ourselves about the role of government as well. And you're somebody who has been on both sides in government as well as in the C-suite and boardroom. But we have seen over the course of this pandemic that there are some things that only government can provide and only government can efficiently plan for. On the other hand, government, as you've suggested, has failed us in so many ways, but not necessarily always in obvious ways. I mean, one of the most interesting conversations we've had on this call has been with Commissioner Bill Bratton, who when responding to some of the issues regarding police in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement in the U.S. And the calls for defunding the police and so on and so forth, is that one of the things he suggests is that it represents a failure of our government and a failure of us as a society. That one of the reasons the police get called out on all of these things is that they are the last bastion, in a way. Things that have not been addressed in our society, inequality, unemployment, poverty, drug use, et cetera, when that then explodes into a problem, only the police is there to deal with it, when it should have been dealt with long before by other elements of government. So how do you see the role of government evolving as you've looked, at their responses to the pandemic?
I think certain countries have done really well in making it very mobile for business people to go into politics and for politicians to go into business. France is a good example. I'm not saying they've got everything right, but moving on to the dark side, as I call it, when I did a couple of years in government, I loved every second of it. I didn't get paid. It was a huge sacrifice in so many ways, but it was just a unique moment, and I really I owe a huge debt of gratitude to Gordon Brown for asking me. I think we need more injection of external talent into government, and the reason for that is it's a tough gig. It's a very, very tough gig with all these issues that we're talking about. Solving them is actually, it's very tough. And you need diversity of thinking. You need diversity of backgrounds. We were talking about this at L1 the other day. We need better leaders across the world at a time of huge change. And we need more mixing of backgrounds. And this idea is certainly in Britain that you leave university or college or whatever or school, and then you become a political advisor, then you become an MP, then you're suddenly running the country. Well, I don't think it works anymore because the complexity of the issues that you and I have discussed are huge. And I think we've also got to accept that we haven't discussed China. Modern democracies are going to have to modernize and have to accept that some of the other big beasts of the economies of the world have a different model.
You know, you bring up this point of needing diversity of experience in government service and that it's a tough gig and whatnot. Do you think that, you know, I think it's becoming clear in the United States that something has changed with regards to government service. And that's partly demonstrated by the sharp partisanship on both sides. But I would also say it doesn't feel like we're sending our A team to Washington or to government service anymore. And part of it is, you know, that there's always been a differential in the remuneration of government service versus private sector, but that's grown extremely large now. But the cost of getting elected, requiring the 24/7 fundraising cycle. The fact that you, your family, everybody you know, everything you've ever done is going to be open for public scrutiny and criticism. Have we poisoned the well, though, in a sense, for trying to attract our best and brightest into government service? And I would add to this question that it appears that in China, still the best and brightest are going still to Beijing and into government service. They are sending much of their A team there, and that's the competitive environment that the Western democracies are going to be facing for the remainder of this century and beyond.
Yeah, look, we could be here all day talking about the U.S. system, and I'm not the expert. I'm just a Brit. But what I would say, I don't like your model of raising this vast amount of money. That for me, it just doesn't make sense, and it's not my idea of democracy. So that needs looking at. I think the whole, the transparency, the exposure of the family and every past activity is a little bit over the top. Doesn't mean say that you shouldn't, you shouldn't be questioned or whatever, but it will put off a lot of people, great talented people who want to make a difference. We need, and it is true of the UK as it is America or anywhere else, we need people with talent who want to make a difference, who are willing to make a sacrifice to move into government, because the nature of the challenges over the next few years, they're going to increase. And I think if I may steer it towards China, the reality of China, it's not going to shrink. Right? The number of people is going to increase. It's going to get more and more technologically savvy. We can treat them as the enemy, but they're not going away. And, they're our partners, and we're in competition with them. There's the nature of global cooperation. But we need them to have a seat at the top table because they're going to be the biggest economy. So I do think we need more internationalism in political leadership. We need more, big thinkers, because the issues are profoundly huge.
Why do you think that, we've talked about the shortcomings of government here to a certain degree, but they aren't to blame for everything. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about society, because government changes faster than society does, at least in the democracies. And yet we've had some democracies that came together and addressed the pandemic in very, very different ways, some with great success, right? So the United States and the United Kingdom, not particularly successful on this front. But Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, democracies all addressed it very, very effectively. And their governments are coming under intense pressure because the pandemic is worsening. But then when you look at the numbers, on a per capita basis, it's still de minimis compared to what we're seeing in the United States. So why do you think some societies have performed better here than others?
Yeah, I'm not sure I got the answer. It's a great question, actually. I do, going back a step, living in Asia for a long time, as I did, one of the most extraordinary things is to see so many talented people going into government. And I, you know, we've had lots of talent going to the civil service in the UK, but I think that, you know, that one of the most extraordinary things that's going on at the moment across every society is innovation. You know, changes that might have taken years now happening in months. So I'm optimistic that we have as a result of COVID, we're going to see extraordinary innovation in science. I mean, one of the proudest things about the last 12 months, and Wellcome Foundation made a statement about it yesterday in the UK, is, wow, didn't science step up in their moment of crisis across the world in the US, UK, et cetera. So I think we're going to see unbelievable innovation, and I mean right across every industry. And that's why I go back on this issue of how do you blend the experience of years of management experience and link in with entrepreneurs and young people who really are moving with great speed. It's a great challenge. I think the other thing is we've had an era of populism, and, you know, we'll see whether that continues. Not sure.
So we've talked about, you know, the private sector, and we've talked about government as sort of discrete silos. Let's talk a little bit about how they can cooperate, because that, it seems to me, is where there is some force multiplication to occur. And we've seen examples of that even this year, right? So, you know, the challenges of distribution and the supply chain and all that are all going to be questioned for a long time. But let's be honest, that Operation Warp Speed was a critical element in getting a lot of private companies to take risk here and to accelerate the development of the vaccines. And in a completely different realm, you could look at something. One image that was positive for a lot of people this summer when things were not that great was watching the phenomenal success of the SpaceX program. And everybody kind of watched that launch and landing like we did the first moon landing. But point being that NASA and, you know, Elon Musk's company worked in great cooperation, and there were subcontractors from all 50 states involved and so on and so forth. So when on big issues, government and the private sector come together, powerful things can happen. Is there more of that germinating out there, do you think, or where are we going?
Yeah, I think, you know, I look at, you know, the changes that have happened in the last year in L1, in our retail business, in healthcare, in tech. It's just, wow, you know, as much change in the last 12 months as happened in the previous 5 years, which means that your management really has to adapt quickly, as I said earlier. What I do think is going to happen is that if your new president, president-elect, is able to get global cooperation, a G20, you know, discussion around the big issues of climate change, inequality, etc., then I would be very optimistic, because if you do that, coupled with the innovation that's going on across the world, we could have just one of the most exciting eras ever. But it will require, you know, a mixing of business and politics, and it will require a mix of countries. One country can't do it on its own. And I think, you know, what COVID did, it highlighted that, you know, people were traveling all over the world and taking the disease with them. We're one planet. We're, you know, and we just didn't react in that way. So, yeah, I do believe there will be, you know, you think of COP21, you know, the climate change conference is going to be held in the UK. That's a big moment for my children and for my children's children. It is the moment when we need to come together. And, you know, I think the health and wellness agenda as an item in the world, you know, I think it's just come center stage. You know, things like obesity, diabetes, etc. You know, we're going to see changes in preventative health and monitoring of health that we'd never seen before. And I think COVID, you know, has done that. And we see that in Holland & Barrett, you know, which is the retailer we own in the UK at Little One. So I think health and wellness, tackling inequality, obesity, et cetera, on a global basis, yeah, it makes me very optimistic. I wish I was 40 years younger.
I mean, on this question of government and private sector cooperation, you know, it seems to me that one of the great drivers of populism that we have seen has been the sort of erosion of or the dearth of opportunity for large segments of our populations, particularly in the sort of middle class and working class elements of our populations in countries like the U.S. and the U.K. and elsewhere. And, you know, economists like to think that there's sort of there's perfect flexibility in systems. You know, if a job disappears in your town, you just move to the town where there is a job. But the reality is obviously far more complex than that. And as we head into this 21st century economy, the digitization and all of the things you're talking about, it seems to me that one of the critical areas that we're going to have to focus on is the retraining of our workforce. And that's not something that can happen overnight. It's not something that's going to happen purely at the major research universities, the Oxbridges and the Ivy Leagues and the like. It's sort of at the community college level where people can be retrained for the industries of tomorrow. But companies are going to have to help guide government as to where those resources should be going and what industries should be and competencies should be focused on. No.
Well, no, I think I look at it another way. If people are going to live till 100 and beyond, right, why would they go to university at 18? Why don't they go 25? If they're going to be working until they're 80 with increased, you know, pension liability, problem of health costs, etc., the whole model for the way we run education, the way we run companies, it's going to change. You know, I think this old style model where, you know, you put your kids leave school, high school, they go to university or maybe they go straight into the workforce. I think it's going to change because they're going to have three or four careers. They're going to live a lot longer. So there are many books written about this, you know. And Linda Grattan in the UK has written a couple of books. It's a fascinating subject. I think if you're a company or a leader in education, you've got to have a think about this. What are we teaching the children of tomorrow and the adults of tomorrow, the children of today, the right values and the right sort of culture and subjects for the world of tomorrow? And I don't think we are. I think in most countries, we're doing the stuff of yesterday. And I think, you know, look, I can't fix that. But if there was one thing I would do, if I was waving a magic wand in that area, I would have a real cooperation in a country and with one or two countries together to look at how we're teaching the youth so that they don't feel you know, they don't get angry, and we're able to, you know, get everybody embracing the need to reduce inequality.
But does the private sector have a role to play here in directing some of this, or is this purely a function of government? I mean, I see that, you know, you look at some at schools and private schools and the like in Silicon Valley area, and they've got an embarrassment of riches in terms of teaching kids at a very early age how to code and whatnot. So that digital divide is growing already, exacerbated by the disparity in availability of technology during the pandemic for students. But does the private sector have a bigger role to play on this education front?
It does, absolutely. I think, you know, I do think we need, post 2008, business, not just financial service, but all business got discredited and it lost its voice across the world. And then we've had the technological giants emerge, you know, Facebook and Amazon, et cetera, et cetera. I think corporates are going to have to do more on this issue of its the back to the original conversation about the role of a corporation. I think, though, as an individual, to you know anybody who's still listening, I would say you've got to first of all look at your strengths, right? You've got to look at what am I good at? What areas do I need to develop? But you also got to think about how am I going to stay relevant? How do I reinvent myself? How do I reskill myself? How do I continue to have a voracious appetite to grow and learn? So I think, you know, companies really need to invest more in learning and training and development. And then we collectively, through webinars, through everything, we've got to get corporates to realize that they're going to have to step up. They're going to have a voice on subjects. They're going to have to speak up, you know, whether it's through Teneo or whatever. You know, corporates cannot stand on the sideline given there's so many issues going on.
So given this tableau that you have painted over the course of this conversation, you know, you represent some very significant investment firms. Given this picture you painted, how do you see the opportunity right now, you know, over the next few years? What are you looking at, you and your colleagues looking at, and how are you addressing the investment climate now?
Well, I think we're looking at the future with great excitement. If I was summing up, this digitalization, this health and wellness that I mentioned earlier, this, you know, reaching into the youth of today, I think what we're going to have is an explosion of innovation and entrepreneurism around the world. And so we, Letter One, as long-term investors, we've got to make sure we're part of that. So, you know, I'm incredibly optimistic that the president-elect of the U.S. will be able, when he's in situ, to bring the world back together for cooperation. I think that is the pivotal thing that he has to do, and he has to unite America. America feels very divided today. And it has to come together. You know, it is the most important democracy and economy in the world, but it's coming across as very divided. And we can't afford for the rest of the world to have America so divided. So I think it's a pivotal moment for America. And I am optimistic. And I truly believe the only way we're going to tackle some of these big issues is cooperation on a global stage. So again, I'm optimistic, but I think as an investor, you've got to make sure you've got the talent that can move with great speed to what is such a fast moving environment. And I think we have a Letter One, and I think in the various things I'm involved in, I think we talk about it a lot at Corsair and ICG, you know, you've the bar is rising on talent. And I think my final comment on talent is, you know, this is an era where evaluation of talent in lots of different ways is going to be one of the big issues for boardrooms.
Yeah, interesting. And you talk about the opportunity presented by these dynamic sectors and where we're going. Looked at another way, have different geographies become more attractive to you or less attractive, you know, as a consequence of the last few years and the evolution of the environment?
I think we have to make sure, you know, the UK is introducing this act, a bit like CFIUS you've done in the US. I think we have to make sure that international investment is very open, you know, and that we don't turn off, you know, every Chinese corporate that wants to invest. On the other hand, we have to, you know, manage national security, et cetera. I do believe that Asia continues to have extraordinary opportunities. And I think, you know, I chaired the UK India Business Council, had a lot of experience in India. I think India remains very, very exciting. as an opportunity, you know, as a country of scale, etc. But so does the whole of Asia. So I don't think I haven't changed my stance on, you know, Europe or US or Latin America or Africa. I think Africa's been slightly forgotten in the last decade. And, you know, COVID obviously, you know, is hitting it badly. But I think Africa will get back onto the global agenda in the next few years because it has been slightly forgotten as a continent in the last year or two.
It is interesting because China has not forgotten Africa. So to the extent that it reemerges in the consciousness of the Western economies, it's going to be a dynamic space for sure. I want to take the last couple minutes here, though, to shift a little bit because, you know, we've been talking about so many elements that pertain to our work, but it may not feel like it. But we do have lives beyond work. And I want to just tap into your experience with organizations and events like Wimbledon and Glyndebourne and whatnot. We are anticipating the return of mass events, whether they be sporting or cultural. I know Wimbledon did not happen in 2020. I'm hoping it happens in 2021. Obviously, Japan is hoping to pull off the Olympics. But how are you and your colleagues in those two spheres, you know, starting to prepare for 2021? And how do you see things changing, and which changes will be permanent, do you think, in how we host these events?
Well, you know, one or two listeners will smile when I say this. Look, you know, when you hang up your boots, you won't be judged on what EPS you produce. You'll be judged on what talent you help produce and what contribution you made to a variety of things, including your company. For me, the more you put in, the more you get out. So I love being involved in the arts and in sport because I'm a sports fanatic. But I think that there is no doubt that the arts across the world, and particularly in the US and, you know, Europe, the arts industry, museums, galleries, you name it, and sports have been decimated by this crisis. And, you know, the US government and UK and other countries have done a good job in putting money to support, you know, the club structures and whatever. But I think a lot of these different parts of the arts are on its knees. And, you know, we need the philanthropists to be very generous. And we need people who can afford to really help the arts. I think on sport, I'm very optimistic about Wimbledon next year. I do think that the consumer appetite for sport is huge now. So I think the sooner it gets back, the better, but obviously in a safe way. So I think, you know, art's really badly hit. And, you know, I think sponsorship is going to be very important over the next few years for the arts organizations.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachawara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.